From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
The federal case against the ComEd 4 is in the hands of a jury.
Federal prosecutors gave it one more go, telling the jury the four defendants in this case crossed the line from legitimate lobbying into illegal bribery. Now, defense attorneys detailed why that's not the case. Lobbying is not illegal, and this is not a bribery conspiracy. This is a business decision. Just a small example of what the defense had to say, showing examples from the trial they say prove everything between former House Speaker Mike Madigan and ComEd was above board. Those closing arguments on behalf of retired ComEd VP John Hooker and former ComEd consultant Jay Dougherty, charged alongside ex-ComEd CEO Ann Promajori and former ComEd lobbyist Mike McLean.
Well, and now the wait, the jury in the Commonwealth Edison bribery trial taking a break for the weekend and will resume deliberations next week. Also, business groups held a lobby day in Springfield. We'll hear more about what they're asking for. We'll talk about all of that and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield, and along with us we have Charlie Wheeler, Professor Emeritus and former Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime State House reporter and observer. And back with us again, we have Hannah Meisel with Capital News Illinois. She's been covering that trial in Chicago for the last several weeks. Hannah, it's good to have you back with us once again.
Always good to be back, Sean. Thank you.
So, Hannah, you've been really following this. You're the expert. The case in the hands of the jury now. I think it's a good way to start our conversation today by giving people just an overview of what the prosecution and the defense, how they wrapped up their cases before the jury. What did they have to say?
Right. So closing arguments began Monday, stretched into Tuesday when ultimately it was given to the jurors. But, you know, they drove home all of their major points. Prosecution, the thrust of the case is that this went way beyond traditional lobbying. This was cozy relationships. Of course, Mike McLean, a longtime friend and confidant of Speaker Madigan's, the two had served together in the Illinois House in the 1970s. He was ComEd's most reliable, by some accounts, the best lobbyist in the entire state house. And ComEd was his biggest client. But as we heard on multiple wiretapped tapes and in letters and emails, you know, he referred to himself as an agent of the speaker and that the speaker was his quote unquote real client. For ComEd, obviously we saw legislation passed in 2011, 2013, that was kind of a fix to that 2011 legislation, the Future Energy Jobs Act in 2016, which of course was also, maybe more driven by ComEd's parent company, Exelon, but still did benefit ComEd. These are three major pieces of legislation that kind of helped ComEd out of a very, very difficult financial time. So the defense, of course, in their closing arguments, they had the jury look at these four individuals, as people and talked about their, personal merits. One of their biggest points that honestly they could have stood to drive home even more was the fact that Smart Grid, the legislation that passed ultimately in 2011 over Governor Pat Quinn's veto, that was originally passed in May of 2011. The legislative leaders, Madigan and then Senate President John Cullerton, they had already, committed to override Quinn's veto by the time that the first, legs of this alleged bribery scheme were getting set up. And so, it's a very, very complicated case. The jury, as we speak on Friday morning, they're not deliberating today, but they've so far deliberated for two full days and that Tuesday afternoon. Four separate defendants to consider. I don't know, no one knows how long they're going to be deliberating, but it has been quite the case to watch.
Yeah, Charlie, there's always speculation that when the longer a jury is out, it favors the defense, because certainly if they come back within just a few hours and return guilty verdicts, kind of slam dunk, the prosecution's made their case. The longer it goes, some people think that. But I don't know, in a case like this, we've had, I think it was over 50 witnesses. We've, you know, been over a month and a half that this has been going on. It's a complicated case, like Hannah mentioned, with the different defendants, too. So should we read anything into the length of time the jury is out?
I don't think we can in the traditional sense, because as he said in his hand, as Hannah has been mentioning, it's a very complicated case. There's four defendants. There's, I don't know how many thousands of pages of transcripts and all these audio recordings and video recordings. And I'm pretty sure the jury has access to all of that data. In fact, Hannah, didn't they ask, as a matter of fact, before they ended up on Thursday, didn't they ask for binders that they can use to sort all the stuff out?
Yeah, that, you know, they asked for two more binders, and they also asked for a transcript that they apparently couldn't pull up on their technology that they have with them in the jury room.
Yeah, and so this, in my mind, they're really taking it seriously, obviously, and they're going over it very, very carefully. And I don't think it necessarily means that, oh, the defense is in good shape or the prosecution is in good shape. It means that the jurors are taking it very seriously. And I think, as we mentioned before, somebody like me who's been around the legislature and watched lobbying for, what, more than 50 years, there wasn't anything in my mind that struck me as illegal in what was going on. I mean, you look at most of the major interests in the state hire lobbyists. They try and woo lawmakers. They try and do things to make lawmakers favorable to their side. And it also struck me the legislation that's at the core, or the most important ones, as you mentioned, the smart grid and then later the Energy Act, they had pretty strong support. As a matter of fact, I'm pretty sure the Republican leadership sponsored one of those bills. So it wasn't as though ComEd had to bribe Mike Madigan to get the bill passed. And another thing that I think is going to be critical is whether or not there was actually money changing hands, if there's actually some tangible benefit given to Madigan himself, some financial benefit. That's not been alleged. That's not been established. And Hannah, you're much more versed on this than I, but wasn't the issue raised at one point that there's a court ruling somewhere that says you got to actually show that there was a quid pro quo? And the presiding judge, Harry Leinenweber, said, well, that may be true somewhere else, but it's not true in our circuit. Am I remembering this correctly, Hannah?
I can't claim to know the details. This is obviously not my regular beat, but there seems to be a sort of circuit split between, you know, what goes on in I want to say the Sixth Circuit and maybe the First Circuit, but we are in the Seventh. And so if it someday goes up to the U.S. Supreme Court, then, you know, maybe something will be different. Of course, Jay Doherty's attorney, Gabrielle Sensenetti, said, yes, but this is his life. I've obviously spent the last 10 years covering legislation, and it's so messy. And it's not like I thought that the courts were, you know, totally tidy. But, you know, I guess I had the sense that, you know, there's more rules and, you know, things were more, you know, clear. But so much of it is very subjective, up to individual decisions. Last Thursday afternoon, you know, I spent a few hours in the courtroom just watching the judge and the attorneys on both sides go over the very technical wording of the, you know, 80-page jury instructions, because the thought is that even, you know, one sentence worded a different way might affect the outcome. It's very, very interesting.
Surely the defense argument, as Hannah mentioned there, was this is how business gets done at the Capitol. And like you said, you've followed this a long time, and you're not really arguing against that. But at the same time, that's been used by other people in other corruption trials. I mean, I'll go back to Rod Blagojevich, for example, and it's not been always that successful of a defense. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, and I think the distinction is that there were no recordings of Michael Madigan saying, oh, this is effing golden, in terms of how I can make money for myself and enrich myself with these ComEd bills, which is a big distinction between Madigan's case and Blagojevich's. And I think it's interesting too, the defense argued that this whole case against the four defendants is part of the Fed's effort to get at Michael Madigan. And so these people are sort of like, what was the term they used, Hannah, the defense attorneys? Collateral damage mm-hmm. in the Fed's quest to bring down Mike Madigan.
Who, of course, faces his own corruption racketeering trial next spring, along with Mike McClain. And so much of this trial has, of course, been, you know, about Mike Madigan. What happens in that jury room will also determine, you know, at least some of what happens next spring with former speaker's trial.
If the jury finds the defendants guilty, it's a certain thing that that verdict will be appealed. On the other hand, if they find the defendants innocent, that's the end of it. The prosecution in a criminal case doesn't get a chance to appeal an acquittal.
Yeah, Hannah, we know there's pressure on the defendants here, certainly, because they don't want to go to jail or pay fines or whatever could happen to them. But at the same time, there's pressure on the prosecution because of this Madigan trial that's looming. I mean, it's sort of built around, as you mentioned, this is sort of building toward a Madigan trial, which is set at this point for next year. So pressure on both sides with the verdict here.
Oh, definitely. And also, you know, one thing we learned in the course of trial, I guess there was a filing a couple weeks before trial began, but it was solidified by an FBI agent who testified early on in the 7 weeks, that this is born out of an investigation that started way back in late 2014. And the original target was always Madigan. And of course, it is sprawled out and, you know, in so many different directions. I don't think we'll ever fully know, you know, how one thing led to another, how this grand jury, you know, nabbed this. It's like, there's so many things that, you know, we don't know about it. But it is an investigation that has rocked Illinois politics to its very core and has forever changed, you know, how this state runs.
Before we move on, Hannah, just since you've been following this every day and in the courtroom, has anything surprised you that you've heard here? I mean, we knew a lot about this case going in. We knew, you know, certain things were alleged, but you've heard all the testimony. Has anything really stood out to you that was like, I wasn't expecting that? It was the bombshell that I had not predicted. Just to get your thoughts now that this is in the hands of the jury.
I mean, there have been a lot of points where I've been surprised. Certainly, for example, a couple weeks ago when Ann Pramaggiore's successor, Joe Dominguez, who took over as ComEd CEO in 2019, was on the stand. He had a sort of run-in with kind of lead prosecutor Amajit Bachchu, and Dominguez on the stand had brought up his proffer interview in September of 2019 and started to say something that, you know, say back to Mr. Bachchu what he had said, and Mr. Bachchu stopped him and he said, you don't want to, you know, you can't say that. You don't want to test this, basically. You don't, you know, that's not going to end well for you, is what he said. In terms of what I've learned about Springfield, I mean, definitely I feel like I saw the last power of Mike Madigan. He definitely flexed that power, used all of his political muscle in the four-year, you know, kind of fight against Bruce Rauner and, you know, Raunerism. And then, of course, Madigan's power began to get stripped away piece by piece starting in 2018. When former political worker Elena Hampton alleged mismanagement in, you know, when she had alleged sexual harassment within Madigan's political organization. And his protectors kept being peeled away. He had to fire his longtime chief of staff, Tim Mapes, in June of 2018. And then all the drip, drip, drip of this investigation starting in, you know, the spring, summer of 2019. And then by 2020, when he was named public official A in ComEd's deferred prosecution agreement. And then, of course, the following 6 months where the pressure on him to resign intensified, and ultimately he was denied a 19th term as House Speaker. And, you know, he left Illinois politics for the most part in February, or, you know, January, February, March, when he resigned all of his positions, except for, of course, he remains the committeeman for Chicago's 13th Ward in the Democratic Organization. I just, you know, one thing that has struck me is the ways in which he really kept up his image as the, you know, the man behind the curtain. And so much of that was through McLean, this hyper loyal person who, you know, referred to him in code as himself and our friend, and, you know, seemed to relish that role that, you know, he had given himself. You know, there's one call that prosecutors played, I think at the very end of their closing arguments, where, you know, McLean was speaking to someone else, and he said, you know, I've been doing this for many years and you've never seen my name in the newspapers. And that is very true.
All right. Well, we'll continue to wait for the jury verdict. The jury is out until Monday, and we'll resume deliberations at that time. You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, along with Charlie Wheeler and Hannah Meisel. Charlie, there was some more good budget news that came out this week. The state comptroller, Susana Mendoza, announcing that the bill backlog has come down. Once again, I think it's under, is it under $1 billion now, which is pretty amazing from where it had gone up to during the budget impasse. So right there, let's talk about the good news first. Seems like the budget is in pretty good shape as we head toward trying to put a new budget together.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, the comptroller put out a news release at the beginning of the week saying that the accounts payable, which used to be referred to as the bill backlog, but it really is no longer a backlog, was under $1 billion for the first time in 15 years. And on Monday morning, it was $941 million. Friday morning, as we're taping it, it stands at $562 million, roughly 7,500 vouchers outstanding. And it's been below a million all week long, and a couple of times it was below it's been below a billion all week long, and half of the week or a couple of days it was less than 500 million. So it's really an amazing turnaround. But at the same time, Mendoza has been warning from day one that we have to be prudent. We can't engage in wild spending. We have to keep a tight cap on things. And she also announced that we made the scheduled $350 million transfer to the rainy day fund earlier this week. So the fund balance is now roughly $1.6 billion. And again, this is the highest it's ever been. And as a matter of fact, 5 years ago, it was $48,000. So there you go.
Now,
in that sense, we're in decent shape.
But there are also some storm clouds ahead. We have talked about this before, the possibility of a, you know, looks like the economy is actually slowing down. Maybe a recession is on the horizon. So there is concern. We're seeing the drop off of that federal money that had been coming in to help with the pandemic. And at the same time, we're hearing some groups out there who want to spend in certain areas, want to make investments in certain areas. Others want to see some taxes rolled back. One of those, the estate tax, that a lot of Republicans are pushing to see that rolled back, at least to some level. And that involves inheritance when you inherit an estate. Right now, I mean, with only a few weeks left to go and this uncertainty that's still there, do you see any major changes with fiscal policy, Charlie?
No, not really. I think that the commitment from the legislative leaders is that we're going to stay the course of trying to be fiscally responsible. And the governor said that, what it was, a month or so ago, he suggested that maybe we could have some tax cuts, but when he was, there was a meeting of the business community and this week, and the governor spoke to them. And after his speech, the reporters asked him about one of the Republican priorities, to repeal the estate tax, the amount of money that heirs have to pay upon the death of a person based on the value of the estate, if your estate is above a certain level. And what Pritzker said, he said, my priority is balancing the budget, making sure that we are continuing our march to credit upgrades, making sure we've set the real foundation for fiscal stability in our state. So I don't think any of these arguments that are being made, I'm not sure any of them are going to be very successful. One of the things, for example, that the local governments has asked is to get a larger share of the state income tax collections. They're roughly about 6% now. Local governments argue that when the income tax was enacted in 69, we were guaranteed 10%. And that's not going to happen, because every additional percent is worth roughly $250 million. There's a push to give a child tax credit for low-income families. That would cost about $700 million. And I don't think that's going to go anywhere. The one that strikes me as really interesting is a proposal to continue a program that we started a year or so ago, to providing health benefits similar to Medicaid for folks who are here without proper credentials, in other words, for immigrants. And the original projections were, oh, this will cost, a few hundred million dollars. Well, the projection for the coming year is more like it'd be $1 billion. And the argument is, there's no way we can afford this. But it strikes me, In on the one hand, how do you take care of these folks? Because if there's not some kind of insurance, it doesn't mean they're not going to get sick. It doesn't mean that they're not going to go to the doctor. They're not going to go to the hospital. Somebody's going to have to pay for it. And one of the arguments in terms of providing this kind of care to immigrants is that with insurance coverage, they may be more inclined to get preventive care rather than wait until they're deathly ill to go to the hospital. So that's one that's, I think it's, we're going to take a hard look at. There's more money. The education community is asking for more money for the schools. Community healthcare centers are asking for another $100 million. There's a press conference just the other day, home care workers asking for additional benefits, money to raise their, what would you say, their salaries, the hourly pay, to try and attract more people in. Another issue, there's a tax credit for private school scholarships that expires this year. And the private school community is arguing that we have to renew this Invest in Kids tax credit. And that's also another, what would you say, financial drain on the state, if you will. So we have all these conflicting pressures. But as I said at the outset, Speaker Welch, President Harmon, both have, I guess, listened to Comptroller Mendoza and to what Governor Pritzker is saying. Our goal is to balance the budget so that we can continue being on this track to get our credit ratings upgraded and to continue to pay our bills on time. One of the things that the Comptroller noted that I thought was interesting, we've saved literally hundreds of millions of dollars by paying our bills on time. And that's money that's not going out the door in late fees, interest payments, and so on. And I'm sure that that is something that we're going to try and continue.
Just a few seconds here left. Hannah, I did want to mention one of the things that came up, the business community that they want to see some changes to. And that is something called the Biometric Information Privacy Act, BIPA, it's often called. This has already resulted in some huge verdicts going against businesses, very costly, and some business groups want to see this changed. Any chance that that could happen here over the next few days before the session ends?
Well, I did a deep dive on this. Gosh, I think it was like late February. And as far as I know, there's obviously energy from the business community and, you know, attorneys who represent businesses in these kinds of lawsuits, which of course have exploded since roughly 2018, even though the law had been on the books since 2008. You know, the technology actually finally caught up, and then kind of cottage legal industry was, you know, had to develop first. But, you know, those who are defenders of the Biometric Privacy Act, you know, they are not that willing. They kind of say, you know, let's wait and see. You know, the legal landscape is still, you know, shifting, and we shouldn't, you know, rush to any decisions on, you know, changing the law, you know, just yet based on a few cases. There actually haven't been very many jury decisions. They've been a lot of times settled. These are shaking out still in the Illinois Supreme Court. This legal landscape is definitely not done settling by any means.
Let's go to our notes from the field, and Charlie, we'll go to you first.
So far in this session of the 103rd General Assembly, there have been more than 6,600 bills introduced. This week, the very first one of them became law. That is legislation that cleared the General Assembly without a single dissenting vote. Governor signed it earlier this week, and it's intended to provide some stability for healthcare professionals and to keep the access to healthcare services as the pandemic emergency rulings expire. What it would do was allow workers who've been practicing under temporary emergency licenses during the pandemic would give them the opportunity to get full licensure and to keep practicing while that licensure process is ongoing. It's a way for folks who came in from out of state under temporary licenses to help us with the pandemic crisis to be able to become fully licensed and stay in Illinois, I guess.
All right. And Hannah.
Senator Chapin Rose, Republican from Mahomet, apparently got stuck in an elevator this week, and scarily, it dropped two floors. We were talking before we started taping, and Charlie was mentioning that when he started at the Capitol, there was still an elevator operator in there, which I actually didn't know. It just speaks to the age of the Capitol building. Obviously, we are in the midst of a three-year major renovation. I remember another elevator for like, I don't know, 2 years. It was out just for 2 years. And from what I heard, it was because there was a part involved that was no longer made. And it's, on the one hand, obviously it's practicalities of infrastructure and, you know, the money it takes to actually maintain a public building like that. On the other hand, it's always cool to go into that building and appreciate the history of the people who have walked those halls before and who will walk those halls, you know, in decades to come.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler and Hannah Meisel with Capital News Illinois. Get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org through the NPR One app or iTunes. Just look for State Week. I'm Sean Crawford. Join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.